Glad to have all of you with us for another edition of Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. We've got a great panel lined up to talk about a broad variety of issues today. Before we get to everybody, a couple of quick notes. We're going to be talking in just a moment about early voting, about votes that have already been cast by absentee ballot. And before we get to that, you've continued to send me a lot of email, which I truly have said over and over again, I appreciate enormously. But one of the things that you ask most frequently is this. You say, when I got my absentee ballot, there were instructions that I should fill it out and put it in an envelope, seal it, and send it back to the state. And you're saying there are no envelopes. And that is correct. Unfortunately, the Secretary of State's office had all of that printed up initially, and then they didn't put those envelopes in. And so what they're asking everybody to do is simply fold the ballot in half. They say that your vote should not be seen through the paper when you fold it over and return it that way. A lot of you think that you're missing a step and are worried that your vote won't count. That is absolutely not the case. Any number of you have also written me to say you're very worried because you haven't gotten your ballot yet, although you sent away for it. And with 1.4 million requests for absentee ballots, the Secretary of State's office is using a fulfillment organization that is making headway. They're getting votes, ballots out. They say there will be no problem. People will get their ballots in plenty of time. So, I mean, that is the news on that front from the Secretary of State's office, and we can only hope that they're able to fulfill that part of the pledge. Okay, I just wanted to clarify that since so many of you have connected to, with me to ask about that. And by the way, if you want to write to me, tell me how you're doing in the coronavirus pandemic, I always, as I've said, appreciate hearing your stories and try to get back to you as quickly as I can. Just send your emails to B-N-I-G-U-T, B-N-I-G-U-T, B-N-I-G-U-T-G-P-B.org. Okay, let's go ahead and get the show underway. Tamara Hallerman, senior reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, is with us. It's Tuesday, her day for being a partner of mine on this show. Tamara, thanks for being here today. Glad to have you with us again.
Always great to be here.
Are you doing all right? You holding up okay? You've got your new puppy, right? Your new puppy whose name I forgot.
Her name is Winnie, but she keeps waking in the night to bark at noises on the street. So I'm dragging a little bit this morning. Your producer caught me yawning, so I'll keep it in check for the show, I promise.
Maybe Winnie should be in a different room, but we don't mind a few barks here and there. Thanks for being with us, Tamara. Professor Audrey Haynes, professor of political science at the University of Georgia, is back with us. She's one of the A-team that have been part of our show on Days After Primary Days. We'll get back to that in a couple of weeks, I think, Audrey. And Audrey, I heard you tell our producer, Tom Faust, or one of our panelists before the show, you've got your Applied Politics T-shirt on today. That's the program that you run that trains your students to go into careers in politics, right?
That is absolutely right. We've been celebrating all of our senior graduates this year and some of our students who have graduated from law school and graduate school. So if you follow us on Instagram, you can see all the great things that they're doing.
All right. Thank you, Audrey. Brian Robinson, who is a former communications director for former Governor Nathan Deal, worked for Congressman Lynn Westmoreland on Capitol Hill for a period of time, and now has his own communications and consulting business. Brian, how are you doing with your, how's your daughter holding up in the middle of all this? She's like, what, 3+ now?
Very good, Bill, yeah. She's doing all right. I mean, she's an introvert.
Have we got you, Brian?
Yeah.
Yeah, all right, I'm not hearing Brian Robinson. I hope we can connect with him in a minute. But I know we have State Senator. Are you there, Brian?
Yeah, I'm here. Okay.
I'm not hearing Brian. So let me introduce State. All right, Tom Faust says he'll work on getting Brian. Look, folks, we're doing our best with this remote broadcast of the show, so I apologize for any glitches we have every now and then. Jen Jordan, state senator, who represents a big swath of Atlanta, northern part of the city, and then way up into Cobb County and all the way over up I think Highway 19 is with us. How are you holding up, Jen, with your family sheltering in place?
We're pretty good. I mean, I think the dogs are getting sick of us, but other than that, you know, it's been nice. So we've been lucky.
I'm really glad to hear you say that. All right, let's move ahead. Let's start with a little conversation about early voting in the state. We had our first day of in-person early voting yesterday. By the way, if you want to know where in your county you can early vote, I believe Sam Burmes-Dawes has posted a link on our social media that will allow you to go to the Secretary of State's office, plug in the county you live in, and it will pop up with the locations that are open in the weeks leading up to the June 9th election. All that said, yesterday it's reported that voting was relatively light, although at one point apparently Cobb County had waits of up to 70 minutes. A lot of that, we're told, had to do with the fact that poll workers are essentially sanitizing equipment after it's been used, and so that slows down the process quite a bit. You may anticipate that you'll wait longer than you normally would when you go out to vote. I'm curious, Jen Jordan, what are you hearing up your way about how the early vote went? Have you gotten any anecdotal information about City of Atlanta and up into Cobb County?
Yeah, I think Cobb County, the lines were long, 30 to, 45 minutes to wait. I think the biggest issue is because of the social distancing that is required between the different machines. You know, the various precincts were supposed to have, let's say they were supposed to have 20, voting machines, and then they've had to pare them down to, 5 to 10. So the capacity issues are really significant. And then there have been precinct issues, too, just because of technological issues and capacity issues. So everybody just needs to be patient. And if they can vote by mail, that's exactly what they need to do.
What we haven't heard at this point is any concerns, Audrey, and maybe they'll start coming in as the vote continues, about the new equipment that's in place. At least we haven't gotten any reports on particularly significant problems, Audrey.
Well, I haven't heard any either, and I'll tell you that at the University of Georgia at SPIA, we were very disappointed. I mean, we were planning on doing some research. We were going to have observers who are going to be looking at the interaction of voters with the new voting machinery and a whole set of things that we were looking at, which have been postponed from November. But right now, I have not heard anyone, especially in my area, having any problems. The one thing we have heard, and we've heard from some of the directors, in Oconee County, things have been going smoothly. They sent everyone in the county a voice message letting them know that they were going to be enforcing social distancing and that they should be prepared if there might be a wait. There were no waits, but they've been very proactive. And, continuing from the Secretary of State's office, they're really encouraging people to vote by mail, especially if they have gotten an absentee ballot and sent it in and requested their ballot, that they should use it, because when they actually, if they show up and go, it takes a little bit of extra time if they're surrendering their ballot back.
Yeah, that's one of the issues that the Secretary of State's office reported yesterday, was people who had asked for an absentee ballot who came instead to vote. It slowed the process down, canceling out that absentee ballot. And the Secretary of State's office, at least, is urging you, be patient. If you haven't gotten your ballot yet, wait for it rather than showing up at a polling place. Tamar, I really was wanting to talk to you about the early numbers we're seeing on the early vote, not just from yesterday, but from the early votes that have been cast by mail, the absentee ballots. And this comes from the Georgia Votes website, which has turned out, Tamar, to be a very reliable site for looking at data about the election. So far, in the 2020 primary election, 415,752 people have voted. At the same time in 2016's primary, that number was 27,947. So the total turnout is like 1,400% higher than it was in 2016. So far, about 42% of the people who have cast early ballots voted Democratic. About 56% picked Republican ballots. And we know that 71% are white voters, 21% African-American, 56% are female, 44% are male. As usual, 55% of those people who've already cast their ballots are 65 or older. Older voters continue to show up in bigger numbers. Tamar, what do you make of all that?
I mean, it's pretty darn amazing. I mean, it shows, first of all, the enthusiasm that we have for this year going into the presidential election. We have two Senate races going on this year. Of course, one of them is not on the ballot. We're only talking about the David Perdue race that we're voting on now. But it also shows just how extraordinary these times are with the coronavirus. And especially when you look at the numbers that Georgia Votes crunched for absentee ballots, the numbers are even more stark than what we saw in 2016. For the 2016 primary, they said about 53,000 people applied to vote by mail. Right now, it's almost 1.5 million. So 2,663% higher. And that's pretty darn amazing to see just how quickly the Secretary of State's office has had to really pivot to that. And my colleague Mark Meese wrote a story yesterday about a special emergency ruling that allows these election officials to begin opening these absentee ballots earlier just to ease the processing of all of this. They can't actually start tallying until Election Day, but just to smooth the process and move it along, they are allowed to start opening the ballots now. Or sorry, 8 days before.
Well, Brian, that's precisely what I wanted to get you in a loop on. Have we got Brian? Have we got you back with us, Brian? We'd lost you for a couple minutes.
No, I'm here. Can you hear me, Bill?
Oh, good, good. I'm glad to hear that. Yeah, now I can hear you. We were having trouble communicating with you a little earlier. Thank goodness you're with us, Brian. What I started to ask, I'm not going to ask you. I was asking initially how your daughter, who is like 3+ years old now, is doing during this pandemic. So go ahead and tell us, because we care about how people are doing personally in the middle of all this.
Well, one thing that she has going for her, Bill, is that, like me, she's an introvert and a homebody. So the lack of interaction with a bunch of kids has not been as devastating for her as I think it is for a lot of kids. But it took 2 months for her to ask, you know, can I take this back to school? Can I take this to school? So she's now realizing that her schedule has been disrupted and she's ready for some normalcy, as we all are, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we're all waiting for that. All right, so let's talk more about the early vote. Brian, I have been surprised, and I've been cautioned by a number of panelists over the last couple of weeks not to be, that the turnout in absentee ballots is so much higher for Republicans than Democrats. 56% Republican ballots, 42% Democratic ballots. Why shouldn't I be surprised by that, Brian?
Well, Bill, I do think that's changing somewhat. I think you saw Republicans requesting ballots early on in much higher numbers, and Democrats are closing that gap now, and it's much closer. And there are a lot more Republican voters' ballots returned, but it's because they got theirs earlier. So I do think that we are seeing closer to parity in the primary voting than what we have seen in the past. And so we'll see if this trajectory continues, Bill. That will be very concerning to me if the Democrat numbers continue to catch up and eclipse the Republican numbers. Because what I want to see as somebody in Republican politics is a stronger Republican turnout, just to show more enthusiasm on our side. Now, that said, there are a lot more exciting races on the Democrat side right now, because you know they're picking candidates for two Senate races, whereas Republicans aren't. There's only David Perdue on this ballot and only Donald Trump on this ballot. So I don't know how much we can glean from it. Democrats have a lot more going on than Republicans do.
Well, wait a minute. I mean, first of all, thank you for reminding me. I was just looking at absentee ballots already turned in. Yes, thank you for reminding me about requests for ballots. Requests for ballots have just about equalized, as you point out. 47% have applied for Democratic ballots, almost 49% Republicans. So you're right, they are catching up. But Audrey, we do have some important Republican races on the ballot, 6th District, 7th District. I mean, there is reason, Audrey, for Republicans to want to turn out and cast their ballot, isn't there?
Yes, and traditionally they do. I would say that some of the more local state-level races are really driving some of the requests. I know in my area, you know, my choice of ballot was driven by a sheriff's election, right? So, you know, there's always those factors. You look at all of those. And I see, the viewers or listeners don't see it, but I see Jen has her hand up, and I know she wants to add something, probably to complement what I just said.
Jen?
Yeah. I think it's important, too. You're looking at the numbers of absentee ballots that have been cast. But one of the biggest things we need to remember, Fulton County, the largest really Democratic county in the state of Georgia and the most populous, they had major issues in terms of processing of applications and are still behind. I know 3 weeks ago, I know they had 135,000 applications in, and at this point, they've only processed 115,000. And they're, you know, people think that they may even get up to as high as 200,000. So I don't think we can really kind of look at the ballots cast yet until all the absentee ballot applications have been processed. And people have had an opportunity to turn them in, especially from the most populous Democratic county in the state.
I think great point, and I take that. I appreciate your mentioning that. While you've got the ball, Jen, and then I'd love to get Tamar in on this as well, what do you make of the potential here with this overwhelming number of absentee ballots that are likely to be cast, despite the fact the state election board said yes, counties can begin processing these absentee ballots like a week plus ahead of Election Day, June 9th. I mean, it is possible, Jen, that we're going to wait days for results in some elections. Isn't it? That's going to be a very frustrating experience for an awful lot of people who not only are candidates, but are concerned about the outcome of the election.
I think we just need that to be our expectation right now. I think what people want are safe, secure elections. And if we start telling folks now, we can't expect like we normally do that Fulton County or Cobb County will have results immediately. Then when people have to wait a few days, that'll still be in line with what they expect. And we really do need to kind of give these election boards a little bit of grace in terms of what they're dealing with. This is a whole new system. And then you put on top of it the, you know, the COVID crisis and all the mail-in ballots. Everybody's just trying to do their best right now. So I just think we just need to set expectations and really just kind of understand that we're all dealing with a lot.
And you can see the messaging. You can see the messaging from the Secretary of State's office right now. They use terms like once-in-a-lifetime unprecedented emergency, you know, painstaking attempts to balance security and transparency. And, you know, I think they know that no matter what, they're going to get slammed by people who are either complaining about voter fraud because so many of these ballots are being conducted absentee, or you're going to get people who are talking about voting rights problems and people's votes not getting counted properly. So I think they're going to be in a tricky spot because this issue has become such a tough one politically over the last couple of years, so politicized. So it's going to be tough no matter what. And like Senator Jordan said, you know, add a pandemic on top of it, it's going to add even more pressure to the situation.
The political science viewpoint, it is unprecedented. There are so many questions that we are going to be looking at. And one of them, you know, Brian can answer. Look at a number of requested ballots and the voting that's taking place when really at the presidential primary level, it's pretty much not a very interesting contest. It's driven by a lot of local elections. And we haven't even seen the level of campaigning and mobilization. And I've seen two ads on television and the debates are on WebEx and things like that. And people are still turning out. Plus, I would also say I thought it was very commendable that the Secretary of State's office sent out all of those requests, I mean, millions and millions of them, to make it easier for people to make that request. And that tells us that when you do make voting easier, people are likely to take advantage of it.
Brian?
Yeah, y'all are absolutely right about local elections driving some of this interest. I wasn't even thinking about that, which is ironic because I'm involved in some of those races that are very high profile. You know, and you know, as far as why Audrey hasn't seen too many commercials, one, she's in Athens, and there's really, you know, the closest election there for her is going to be the 9th district, which does dip into part of Clark County. And so there's not going to be as much where she is. But you are seeing a lot of cable stuff up in Northwest Georgia for the 14th district here in the 7th, and none in the 6th just yet because, you know, Karen Handel is the presumed nominee essentially there, even though it's a big field. Not going to be a lot of spending. And then, of course, in the 9th district up in Northeast Georgia. So you are seeing a little bit of TV ads. You can see them on cable. And you're not going to see much on broadcast, one, because it's super expensive, and two months ago, every campaign's fundraising basically stopped. It just hit a brick wall. And so we're going to have a really skimpy campaign spending season from here through June 9th. So you're going to see less, maybe less mail, less digital, less TV than what you would normally see. Yet we're still seeing record turnout. So it's extraordinary. It's really hard, to Audrey's point, to know what is moving voters. What is working in an era where we can't spend enough money to reach a large electorate?
Well, you know, Jen Jordan, Audrey makes a point, and Brian seconds it, that, you know, there aren't a lot of really exciting big races. Well, there are a couple. I mean, the Democrats have an interesting Senate race. We're going to talk about that in a minute. But, you know, we're pretty much, it's a foregone conclusion, basically, that Joe Biden is the Democratic presidential nominee. What's the impact, not necessarily for June 9th, but moving toward November, and how does the energy build around Jill Biden's virtual visit, Jen, to Georgia on Thursday? She's going to be doing a virtual coffee with medical workers down in Albany, which has been so hard hit by the virus. She, of course, herself is a doctor. Then she's doing something with Atlanta Teachers and at some point holding a campaign event. And I raise that question partly because there's been so much concern among Democrats about Joe Biden sort of being pinned down in his basement trying to get the message out. What does an event like the Biden event being virtual mean, do you think, in terms of energizing people?
I think the campaign's just trying to be connected or stay connected with people as much as they can. But the news cycle is being driven by Donald Trump every day in terms of what he's saying with respect to the pandemic, or how the crisis is actually being managed at the state level, too. And it's really almost impossible to kind of break out of that. And so really all they can do, you know, are kind of events like this where they can just stay connected to people and really kind of communicate with respect to what they would be doing or how they would manage, you know, the crisis versus what's going on. Because there's just no way. I mean, you wouldn't have enough money in the world to be able to kind of message over or to drown out exactly what's coming out of the White House. So, you know, I think they're doing what they can. But what's interesting, though, to me is the number of, in terms of the applications for absentee ballot, the overwhelming number of people who did not vote in the 2016 primary. And, you know, folks may say, well, that's not that big of a deal. But primary voters, I mean, you have to be very intentional and you've got to really want to vote with respect to, you know, a Democratic primary or a Republican primary to kind of show up for that. So I'm going to be watching, you know, like you said, how many ballots are actually returned with respect to the parties, because for Democrats, this is, I mean, we have not had this. I mean, Republicans historically have done very well with absentee ballots. And getting them back in. But for Democrats, this is just something we don't see.
All right. This is going to be fascinating to watch. And one of the things tomorrow that's going to make it even more interesting is, and we've talked about it on the show a couple of times now, this internal poll that was conducted by a PAC that supports Governor Kemp that the AJC managed to get a hold of, which shows that the race for November, the presidential race in November, as of May, is basically deadlocked between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. Biden shows up with 47% of support, 46% for Donald Trump. There's a 4% margin of error. But what's really interesting about the poll beyond the presidential race tomorrow is this internal poll shows that David Perdue is leading John Ossoff by just 43% to 41%. That, too, is in the margin of error. But there are a couple questions I want to ask, start with you about on this tomorrow, and then I get the rest of the panel involved in this as well. First of all, at the same time that this poll shows a closer race than Republicans may have expected that Perdue was going to face in November, the other thing that's fascinating to me about it is it pulls Ossoff, but not Teresa Tomlinson, not Sarah Riggs Amico. The notion that they're being written off, I know the Tomlinson folks have been really frustrated by that, and I'm sure you've received communications from them about it. I have as well. But Tomlinson's campaign, Tomlinson herself said the other day, don't squander this opportunity. We've really got a chance to beat David Perdue. And the Cook Report has actually moved that race from likely Republican to leaning Republican. So why don't you start us off on that, DeMar?
Sure. Well, going into this primary, John Ossoff was kind of the best known out of the three Democrats, you could argue, given his run in the 6th District special election in 2017. He famously raised $30 million for that race. He started as a 29-year-old unknown and came within about 4 points of winning there. And so I think Republicans were kind of eager to go up against him again because they think they know the playbook to beat him. You talk to Tomlinson and they say, you know, she says, well, sure, everyone knows who John Ossoff is, but they still don't want to vote for him. And you know, his retort is that, you're not even good enough to be pulled. So who knows at this point? But it is pretty remarkable that at least in the eyes of Republicans, that they don't see Tomlinson and Amico as a threat at this point.
Well, and I would add to what Tamar said, if you watch the debate, if you watch the Democratic Senate debate and you watch what the activity was, I think that her opponents thought that she was someone who was kind of critical because a lot of the attacking and the strategic questions were going to Teresa Tomlinson. And so we're all in these bubbles, and there's been a lot of small, limited polling. So I think that, you know, they may not really be sure what's going on. I've seen a lot of buzz for Tomlinson lately. And I know that Amico has been really driving in her emails. I mean, there's a lot of activity. And if you look at the ballot, too, you know, I'll say this about people who are voting. Amico's right there at the top, and it's a long list of candidates for people who are going in there and they're just voting for the Democratic candidate, not thinking about, you know, which one they really like. Tomlinson is at the bottom, and Amico is at the top, and Ossoff is buried in there because it is a long list of candidates.
Brian, November's a long way off, and given, especially as we've said on the show several times already today, especially in this pandemic environment, there are so many variables that can affect all of the numbers that we're seeing right now. Right, Brian?
Oh, yeah. There's a ton of things that play into this, Bill. Yeah. Are you thinking about anything in particular?
Well, no, Bill? Just the fact that, yeah, Brian, I'm asking you as a Republican what you think when you see what appears right now to be Perdue in a more vulnerable position than I think many Republicans thought he'd be. He's got a huge fundraising advantage over all of the Democrats combined. The Tomlinson campaign likes to point out that they've come to parity in the last cycle with John Ossoff in their fundraising. But with all the advantages Perdue seems to have, including incumbency, at this internal poll by Republicans seems to show him more vulnerable than I think people would have thought. And I'm curious your reaction to that.
Yeah, and let me start off, first of all, with the poll. There's still some questions about it because some of the numbers in there were real outliers from recent polling we've seen from other bodies, some of it internal, some of it third-party polling. So we still need to see what the questions were. We need to see what the crosstabs were. So just let me raise that flag about that poll. But I talked to the Purdue people, and they fully understand that, yes, they've got the advantage of incumbency. They've got the advantage of a large war chest. They are in a historically red state. But they acknowledge that the landscape has changed. I mean, you look at 2018, and you've got to acknowledge that anything can happen on election day. When it's 1 percentage point out of 4 million votes, there's no guarantee of one party having an advantage over the other. So they're expecting something really tight. And as far as the war chest goes and how tight it is right now, let's look forward out of this present moment where the Democrats are up on the air. They are running ads basically right now showing their African-American support. They're sort of jockeying in that sector of the voting block. And David Perdue is not up on the air. He's not spending money to communicate with voters. Democrats are going to spend a lot of what they have on hand in the primary, particularly if they go to a runoff, getting them really close to November, spending money attacking each other. David Perdue is going to be able to consolidate support. He's going to be able to raise more money and preserve it, and then have a deluge in the fall leading into the election. So he's still in the poll position here. He's where you would want to be if you were in it. But look, there is no sitting on the sidelines thinking that they got this in the bag. The Purdue people know they've got to fight.
All right, let's do this. Let's get to our first break of the show. We have a lot more to talk about because today we're focusing on our core mission here at Political Rewind. That's politics. We'll be right back. We're back on Political Rewind. Professor Audrey Haynes, Senator Jen Jordan, Tamar Hallerman of the AJC, senior reporter at the AJC, and Brian Robinson are on with me today. Tamar, I want to talk, and again, I'll start it off with you. Let's talk about Stacey Abrams for a couple minutes, because what show about politics in Georgia would be complete without at least some conversation about Stacey Abrams? Mark Leibovich, who is one of the New York Times' finest writers and political journalists, had a piece in the paper today. And the point of his story was that, I'll just read you the first couple of graphs of it. He says, traditionally, prospective vice presidents were asked if prospective vice presidential candidates were asked whether they would like to be so-and-so's running mate, they typically follow some variation on the familiar dodge. They would say how flattered and humbled they were to be mentioned before claiming they were not really thinking about getting selected. Not at all. Not one bit. In other words, they must be reluctant or at least act reluctant. But that custom is fading in this strange lockdown of a VP stake season. Prospective running mates appear more and more to be shredding their fake reluctance or not bothering to shred their ambition at all. Ms. Abrams, who barely lost the Georgia governor's race in 2018 and whose name has seemingly been bandied about as a potential Democratic running mate ever since, has repeatedly flouted this first rule of non-campaigning for the vice presidency. Tamar, this continues to be a fascinating story. Stacey Abrams being very, very candid about saying, I think I'd be a terrific candidate for vice president. Talk about how you think. Oh, I should add to that, the Washington Post published a piece over the weekend saying that what she's doing is complicating Joe Biden's decisions on who he wants to choose. Go ahead. You take this up, Tamar.
Sure. I mean, it's creating an awkward situation in that, you know, if Joe
Tamar,
Biden
do I have
not...
you?
Hello? Can you hear me?
Are you all back? Can you all hear me again? What do you make of the fact that, okay, you've always heard me. I'm terribly sorry to my panelists and to all of our listeners. I have no idea why we're struggling so much today. We haven't had this problem too often in the past. Jen Jordan, what do you make of the fact that Stacey Abrams has been so out front in saying, yep, I'd be a great choice for vice president?
You know, it's been interesting and really unorthodox. And what's been interesting is to see kind of the press coverage, because it's gone, you know, there have been these glowing kind of pieces on her, and then you'll have some other pieces that'll say this is complicating things, and then some pieces that aren't so glowing. So it's really just been playing out at a very high level. But at the end of the day, she's really kind of changing, you know, the narrative and how people approach it for good, bad, or ugly. And so, you know, it's going to be interesting to see exactly what happens with respect to Biden's choice.
And I think, I think, you know, on the one hand, this certainly helps get her out there even more, this kind of unabashed campaigning for the role. But it also does set up an awkward situation for Biden, because if he doesn't pick her, then he risks disappointing a lot of activists in the party who maybe wanted somebody, a younger woman, a woman of color to be a part of this, too. So it's also interesting to see just how much, Abrams and her playbook are kind of inspiring other figures to kind of also state their interest publicly. We saw Susan Rice, who was President Obama's national security advisor, say she'd be interested. We've even seen Elizabeth Warren say she'd accept the offer. And maybe it'll lead to a permanent change in the way that this sort of shadowy campaigning for vice president that we used to see, what that looks like going forward.
I would also add in there, excuse me, lost my voice for a moment, but, you know, Biden has this context, and the big context is South Carolina and the endorsements he got from the Black community, and the fact that he has already said that he is going to choose a woman. He has boxed himself in a little bit himself. And so, you know, if you take that calculus of a woman of color, there is a set of women that he may be looking at. Now, how that fits into the general election, you know, we can't be sure. No presidential vice presidential nomination pick is the end all. It doesn't solve all your problems, and it doesn't get you to where you want to go. So, you know, whatever happens, happens. But this is new. It is interesting. Women who are ambitious are no longer being coy about it. There's not that faux. Everyone always knew people wanted to be the vice president, even though they were saying, I'm not sure. But they were doing it for political reasons. The only thing is, when you don't get it at the end, that can hurt you a bit, you know, especially if you look like you really wanted it badly and they said no. So, you know, obviously Stacey Abrams is a risk taker, and she is doing something more novel and, as Tamar said, sort of setting the standard for others. So we'll see what happens. It'll be a big news story when he chooses.
Brian, I've said on the show a couple of times, and I'd love to get your take on this, that the people who are either poking fun at Stacey Abrams for being so out front in pursuing the possibility of being the VP candidate, or are criticizing her for it, I think it's easy to forget that when she ran for governor in 2018, she laid out a whole new playbook for how she thought she could win this race. Suddenly saying there are more progressive voters in Georgia than the Democrats have given credit for in the past. I'm going to pursue them. I'm going to get them to the polls. You know, there were people then who thought that she was not going to have a great deal of success, and yet she proved that her own vision of how to move forward could be pretty darn successful, even though she lost that race. So it seems to me personally, Brian, that it would be a terrible mistake to just sort of criticize Stacey Abrams for this campaign and dismiss it as being somehow frivolous or not potentially successful. What do you make of that, Brian?
Fortune goes to the bold, Bill. That's what I see. And I think Stacey Abrams has proven that time and time again. It's a conversation that I've had with Senator Jordan, actually talking about Stacey Abrams and just sort of the force of nature that she is. And I continue to stand in awe of how someone who ran for an office in a state became the national phenomenon that she became when she actually lost that race. And the way that she has been able to effectively plant in the nation's conscience that somehow the election was stolen from her, even though there's no evidence that backs that up in any possible way. I mean, she's pulled off a tremendous accomplishment, regardless of whether you're a Republican or Democrat in Georgia and how you see her record. So never count her out, man. I mean, she is wicked smart. I mean, to grow up in poverty in Mississippi and to end up at Yale Law School, you're by definition an extraordinary person. So she's unlike anybody else in politics. I mean, she breaks so many molds, doesn't she? I mean, if you just go down the list of attributes about her that you can't ever count her out. Now, here's the thing, though, Bill, and I just to take it the next step, the message against Joe Biden is going to be that he is mentally slipping, that he's, you know, sleepy Joe, that he's confused, that age is catching up with him in a way that is notable when you watch him on TV. There's going to be an onus on him and on his staff around him to have someone who meets the credibility threshold, somebody who's had national experience, foreign experience, legislative experience on the national level, that Stacey would be credible if she had won the election in 2018. She had 2 years of being governor under her belt, but she doesn't. And I think that's a huge liability for her in this scenario. That doesn't mean she's not extraordinary. It doesn't mean she's not smart. It doesn't mean she wouldn't do a good job. I just think that given the number of highly qualified and smart women candidates that Biden has to choose from, there's going to be a drive amongst those around him to get someone with more experience.
So before we take a break, which we got to do pretty quickly, Jen Jordan, I want to give you, since you're the Democrat on our panel today, the last word on this. I take Brian's point has been made by any number of people that she doesn't have, Stacey Abrams doesn't have the national, international credentials to take on this role. But Jen Jordan, I remember in 1992 when Bill Clinton was heavily criticized for choosing another Southerner to be his running mate when he picked Al Gore, and political pundits across the country said, how foolish, you can't have two candidates from the same region on the ticket, it'll never work. So, Jen Jordan, you never know what the chemistry and the dynamic is going to be between a presidential and a vice presidential candidate.
Yeah, and let's be clear. I mean, this crisis has really changed the calculation, too. Pre-COVID-19, the Biden campaign, their main thing may have been about energizing progressive voters and energizing young voters to get out. And Abrams may have been kind of at the top of the list. But then when this crisis took over, what you're looking for in terms of a number two with respect to what the voters want, I mean, experience, you know, somebody who's done it, who's been there, who knows how to get the job done, kind of a known quantity. It's a very different kind of calculation. And so that's what's been interesting. It's not that Abrams has never been considered or wouldn't be considered. It's just that who is the right person at the right time? And things actually may have changed pre and post COVID.
All right, let's do this. Thank you all for that. We've got to get to our final break of the show. When we come back, we got a few minutes left to tackle yet a few more issues. We'll be right back. We've got just about 5-plus minutes left on today's show, and I want to use like 30 seconds of them to apologize to all of you out there listening and to our panel as well for the technical glitch we had a while ago. You know, our engineers have done a phenomenal job allowing us to do our show by remote for more than 2 months now. And every now and then, some glitch as simple as a button sticking on a control board creates problems for us. So I'm terribly sorry that we had an issue for a little bit of time there. Let's get in at least one final issue. And Tamar, let me start with you on this. The polling that we're seeing continues to show that Brian Kemp is being held accountable for starting to reopen Georgia, and that it's an issue that people are still uncomfortable about. Now, he's not on the ballot for two more years. But I think the question is, to what extent will this affect other races in as we move forward toward Election Day in November? Do we think that other Republicans on the ballot are going to either win some votes or lose them based on what happens in the months ahead?
There are two Republicans that I'm really looking at when it comes to kind of the impact of the coronavirus, and for two different reasons. The first is Kelly Loeffler, his pick for Johnny Isaacson's Senate seat. She's not on the ballot until November, but she's been under fire for weeks now for her stock trades related to, you know, right after her getting a private senator's only coronavirus briefing. And you know, her Democratic opponents, as well as Doug Collins, have really kept the pressure on her, and it does not seem to be going away. So I'm going to be watching that closely. The other person I'm going to be watching is David Perdue, and mainly just because he's tied himself so closely to President Trump. And because of that, I think however Trump does in November, I think will be in no small part based on how the economy is doing and how the how people perceive his coronavirus response. So I think how people vote on Trump is how they're going to vote on David Perdue.
Audrey?
I think Tamara is absolutely right. That would be exactly what I would say, too. And, you know, this is going to be a very interesting election, and it will have some down-ballot consequences. I mean, a lot of people are talking about the election and calling it like the Teflon election, that we're so polarized that, you know, the Democrats are going to vote for anybody but Trump, and the Republicans are going to continue to support their candidate, and nothing will change, and it'll be about turnout and mobilization. But the consequences of this pandemic are going to have an effect. And, you know, I think they may move a little bit of that polarization if you are affected by it. So we really have to watch and see what the consequences are. And it could affect everyone, especially those who are in power.
Brian and Jen, I want to give you a quick chance on this, too. Brian, why don't you go first?
I'm sorry, Bill. What was the question?
Jen Jordan. We don't want Brian Robinson doing the show from his house. Jen Jordan, what's your take on how the coronavirus, the success or the failure that Brian Kemp has in opening up the state, is going to have on candidates moving forward?
Look, I think it could have a significant impact, but let's understand, this isn't just kind of a one-off. I mean, we're going to be dealing with this, I mean, through the election. So things are warmer now. I mean, we understand folks are outside, so transmission levels may be lower. There's all this kind of stuff that may make people think that things are okay and kind of turn back to normal. And then we head into the flu season and we get walloped again right about the time that, you know, it's November and we have another election. So I think it's important that we need to kind of watch the polling and kind of see how people are reacting. But this definitely isn't kind of a, you know, he opens and then we can tell one way or the other. I think this is basically going to be people evaluating constantly up until November.
Yeah. And look,
I need to ask you one more quick question. Yeah, go ahead, Brian.
Brian Kemp's not on the ballot this November, but Donald Trump is. And I do think that Donald Trump's fortunes in Georgia and in other parts of the country will depend on the results of his fight against the coronavirus. And if there is economic growth in the second half of the year, like the Federal Reserve Chairman suggested on 60 Minutes, if we seem to be on the right trajectory, a lot of what's happening today in May is not going to be relevant. What's going to be relevant is what's happening in September and October. Have we returned to some sense of normalcy? Are people less scared? Are people less anxious? And they feel like the country is on the right track. So I don't think Brian Kemp's performance is going to make a big difference, even in Georgia. I think it's all going to come down to Trump. And that'll have a huge implication for David Perdue, but also have a huge implication for Karen Handel, the nominee in the 7th District as well. Trump will be who brings you up or brings you down.
Jen Jordan, I've got like very little time, like a minute plus. Do you have a date yet for going back into session? I know that the lieutenant governor was looking at June 15th. The speaker was talking about June 13th. Do you know when you're going to be going back into session now?
No clue. They're supposed to be working it out, and I guess we'll all know at some point.
Well, I want to invite you to come back soon because you're on the Appropriations Committee in the Senate, and we really need to hear your thoughts on where the heck this state is headed with a budget that you've got to have together in time for the fiscal year to start in July. So we'll look forward to talking about that again on Political Rewind. That's it. We're completely out of time. Again, my apologies for the technical glitch. Audrey Haynes, Brian Robinson, Tamar Hallerman, and Jen Jordan, thank you so much for being with us. Thanks to all of you for joining me today for Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. See you again tomorrow. Take care, and please stay healthy.